started here. Thank you all for coming. Around 4 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. This is sleepy time.
For you.
Okay, good to know. Okay. And I'm thinking of what, you know, Ken has been telling us about what happens by late afternoon in terms of the rational mind. It's not working quite as well. But
yeah, refresher.
And I think of these sessions in some ways as Wes and Sue part two. We're covering some of the same territory. And as I've been, continually reformulating it, it's like three questions. Where have we come from? Where have we come from? Where have we been going? And how did we get here? Right? There's an old Talking Head song, right? That's something like, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. My God, how did I get here? And it's this mystery song. I began the last session with a quote from James Baldwin, and I'll repeat it from an essay called The Price of the Ticket. In the church I come from, which is not at all the same church to which white Americans belong, we were counseled from time to time to do our first works over. Go back to where you started, or as far back as you can. Examine all of it. Travel your road again and tell the truth about it. Sing or shout or testify or keep it to yourself, but know whence you came. And again, this is so much of what we're hearing, I think, from so many different people in so many different ways this week. Obviously, Wes and Sue have taken us back to Genesis. But I think, Ken, what you're doing as well, in certain ways, is also, just in terms of the mind, the brain, we're just looking at how this, who we are, where we come from. Here's a second quote. This one's from Mahmoud Darwish, who is a Palestinian poet, passed away a few years ago, the most famous Palestinian poet. When Darwish died, there were, just thousands upon thousands of mourners. He is considered the Palestinian poet. This is Darwish. In every poet, there is a loss or an absence. In every poet, there is an Andalus. I'm going to pause there. In every poet, there's an Andalus. What does he mean? What is he referring to? An Andalus. This is a little obscure. An Andalus. Andalusia. It's a geographical location.
Spain.
Yeah. But it's also, in a way, it's a state of mind for Darwish that goes back to a time when three Abrahamic faiths were all working together, right, before Ferdinand and Isabel. Right? I'm going to come back to that, which is one reason for this quote. So for Darwish, the idea of Andalus is this place where artists, philosophers, theologians, people were exchanging ideas, right? And if you want to wrap somewhat whimsical, you can talk about Holden as a kind of Andalus, an Andalusia, right? In every poet, there is an Andalus. And poetry is the search for an Andalus that is possible to recall, able to be presenced. From here grows the mysterious happiness, not in reality, but from creation, where the words are able to capture the impossible, the complicated statement. Poetry is the search for an Andalus that you can recall, meaning it did exist in some form. And I go back to what I said 2 days ago about Bruce Springsteen's experience at the Obama inauguration. It's like, here is the country that I imagined, that the poets have imagined. That's what Darwish is talking about. So there's this mysterious happening, not in reality, because it doesn't fully exist here. But from creation to creation, the poetic creation, the imagination, where words are able to capture the impossible. That's where it exists. And we're trying to find ways to manifest it. All right. I want to give an alternate, and I sometimes do this in class. I teach at Evangelical Christian University, Jefferson University. So I love throwing Asian philosophy and theology at them. A Chinese poet named Du Fu, 8th century Chinese, thought of as maybe the greatest lyric poet in Chinese history. It's called Written on the Wall of Chang's Hermitage. Okay, so Chang's Hermitage, right? So he's going on this journey, this pilgrimage, to find this monk named Chang. It is spring in the mountains. I come alone seeking you. The sound of chopping wood echoes between the silent peaks. The streams are still icy. There is snow on the trail. At sunset, I reach your grove in the stony mountain pass. You want nothing. Although at night, you can see the aura of gold and silver ore all around you. You have learned to be gentle as the mountain deer you have tamed. The way back forgotten, hidden away. I become like you, an empty boat floating adrift. That's again a kind of Holton poem with deer wandering around up in the mountains. So here's one idea of a journey, going from one place to another, seeking something. And the image with my students, when we hit those final lines, I become like you, an empty boat floating adrift, positive or negative.
Depends.
Yeah. You're not Episcopalians, are you? I mean, that's a very. I'm Episcopalian, so I can say this. That great middle way. Right? For my students, almost always negative. Right? Floating adrift, empty boat, negative images. For Du Fu, this is enlightenment.
Right?
Enlightenment. Arrival. So I'm thinking of this in the context of Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. All three of whom, I'm just again following the trail that you guys have been blazing, so to speak. That there are these, they all have these journeys. So Abraham called out, goes on this journey, and arrives somewhere. And one of the places he arrives is what we think of now as Hebron, in the West Bank. We talked about that a little bit. Moses called out of Egypt. And Jesus called out, baptism, 40 days in the wilderness, obviously modeled on the Exodus story. So there are these literal journeys. And I'm also thinking what I think Sue has been inviting us to experience is that the literal journey is also a spiritual journey, a psychological journey, an emotional journey, an internal journey. So this question again, where are we being called to? Right? There's a literal question to that, but there's also this internal question. Where are we being called to? And I like to think of it in juxtaposition to the Du Fu poem. Just called going up that mountain path, seeking the hermitage. Doesn't find the hermit, but finds what the hermit represents. Finds that place of openness, of receptivity, and so on. Okay, so the Abraham story. Briefly going to go back to some of what I was talking about 2 days ago. Quote from Genesis 18:19. And figure out who's speaking here. I have chosen him, that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. I have chosen him. Who's speaking? God. And I don't know, it'd be interesting to look at the Hebrew on this. Right? I'm working with the English here, and I love the way the English the syntax. I have chosen him. Right? God is the subject. Abraham is the direct object. that he may charge his children. Right? So here it becomes Abraham is now the subject, right? And some kind of charge over the children, right? To keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. That's the key, the call. Right? So that the Lord may bring to it. So once again, it's the Lord now subject, Abraham the indirect object. So Abraham is the recipient of the action, right? And in that middle part, Abraham becomes a subject, and the children are wrong. Right? It's a beautifully constructed sentence, at least in the English, that indicates this movement that has to do with doing righteousness and justice. So that's really what the call is. So he gets, he travels, right? From where? Ur, which is where?
Babylon.
Okay. Euphrates, you know, Tigris and Euphrates, cradle of civilization. So that's one of the motifs that I want to try to move, is cradle of the civilization. Right? And this is where you guys were. Okay. So he's called out from that place into another place, away from that cradle of civilization. Into another state of mind would be a way of putting it. The mystery of this call. What does that sound like? What did he hear? What did he hear? So he travels up the Euphrates. The map I've got in my head, at least. Up the Euphrates, and then back down, and ends up at this place, Hebron. And the one place he makes a purchase, and this again is connecting back to what Wes and Sue have been talking about, and is highlighted in Wes's book. And, he makes one purchase, which is what? What does he buy? In very particular, land for what purpose?
Burial.
Exactly, burial site. And you do have a sentence or two in your book that suggests that there's something questionable about this. That there is no indication, there's been this call that he's been following all along. And suddenly, we don't hear about the call. We hear him making this decision to purchase this place. Right? And I may be putting too much weight on this, but it's one of the threads that I'm really interested in. Because of what happens with Hebron. And the fact that what he purchases is a burial site. Right? It's almost as if, and this is a hypothesis, right? That we're, instead of arriving at a beginning with Abraham, right? That we're already at the you could say, the beginning of the end. Right? That something is going to go awry, which of course we see biblically. And to move ahead, to me it's not coincidental, and this I touched on 2 days ago, that Hebron was the site of the first of the religious, the fanatical settlements in present-day Israel. And that it was, in a couple of cases, Americans who were responsible for that. In particular, right, there was a disciple of a man named Rabbi Koch, who brought 60 people to spend the Passover holiday in Hebron Hotel and then refused to leave. I mentioned this 2 days ago. And that was the origin of that first settlement. This is 1968, just a year after the occupation, 1967. And then comes Rabbi Meir Kahane from Brooklyn, founder of the Jewish Defense League in New York, moves to Israel in 1971, founds a political party. One of the aims of the political party was making sexual relations between Jews and Arabs a capital crime. Well, this takes us back to Ezra, Deuteronomy, and so on. Once again, how did we get here? The party's eventual goal was the expulsion of all Arabs from Israel and the occupied territories. Well, Deuteronomy, Joshua. Yeah, we are repeating ourselves. Since 1967, and this is part of what I work on, is this Israel-Palestine material. So just to bring it more up to date, since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank, there are more than 125 settlements with 600,000 inhabitants. Explicitly segregated communities. And part of what we're doing here is also just making the move between Israel and America. Because this is all really familiar to us.
Yeah. I've got a question. So part of what you're talking about is with Arab Palestinians, but what about Christian Palestinians?
Mm-hmm.
Where?
Same thing.
Where are they falling into this?
Christian Palestinians are Palestinians from the point of view.
But those are lumped in with the Arabs.
Yeah. And they are. I mean, yeah. And the number of Christian Palestinians, just as throughout the Middle East, of course. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. 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 So segregated communities, many places, of course, we know there's a wall that separates them from the Palestinian villages below, separates villagers from their land, their trees, their food, their income, gated communities protected by the Israeli Defense Force. Separate roads, right, that Israeli cars, only Israeli cars, Israeli license plates can drive on, and so on. There's a wonderful Jewish historian, Ilan Pappe, who most famously wrote the book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I mean, this is an Israeli Jewish historian, right, who no longer teaches in Israel. He's in England. He's in Israel. Right. He also wrote a book called The Idea of Israel. And he's just trying, again, this question of, what is this idea? Right. What is this idea? This is what he says. The images and narratives formulated by Zionist leaders and activists in the past and Israeli Jewish intellectuals and academics in the present present Israel as the inevitable successful implementation of the European history of ideas. Ideas are the transformative agents that in any narrative of Western enlightenment lifted Western societies out of medieval darkness, helped restore civilization following the Second World War. Israel was one such transformative idea. One Zionist scholar chose to call it not an idea, but a utopian ideology that had been translated into fact. And so Israel is the embodiment, from this point of view, the embodiment of a culmination of European civilization. Is there any irony here? Think about Europe, how Europe treated the Jews. I mean, it's peculiar, really. But that's very much the model in Israel. Right? And the Palestinians, right, are the Indians, essentially. The Israelites are the ones that are cultivating the land. You go back. What Wesson Tzu has been talking about, and cultivating the land, right, is what we do as civilized people. Right? We transform, we make better. And the language that's used over and over again in the Israel documents about this is that we redeem the land, right, as if it's the human activity to do this. All right. Abraham to Moses. And what I want to do now is just weave some threads that will be, I think, familiar to you. Okay? Occasionally I'll comment on them, but that's right. Yeah. So the Moses story. Moses. What does he see? What does Moses see from that hill across the Jordan? That's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. Well, that's earlier, of course, right? Before everything else happens. But I'm taking him to the end of his journey. Right? And And again, you can go to the place in Jordan where there's this hill and there's this plaque that says this is where Moses this is where Moses is. It's like you can go to the baptism site on the Jordan River. Right. And there are two or three baptism sites. Right. Depending on who you're listening to. So there's Moses looking down. What do you see?
Promised land.
Yeah. Okay. What does that mean?
It's the land that they've been headed toward and where they've been going.
Yeah. Right. So there's certainly a literal answer to that. Right? I mean, he sees. Sees fertile fields and land and milk and honey. Is there a more metaphorical answer to what he sees? Or to what the promised land means?
I wonder if he's seeing the destination of his call. I mean, for me, the promised land oftentimes can be seen as a beginning or something out there that you're moving toward. But it's not yet in existence. It's not there yet. Or an ending.
Right.
Like a destination.
Yeah, destination, a goal, certainly.
But I think basically it's the end of his journey.
Yes. Yeah. And it is literally, we know he's not able.
We know he's not going to finish it.
Yeah.
And then, in contrast to the Christian Western notion of terra nullis, I don't know if you're going to get to Doctrine of Discovery this week or not, but...
Yeah, I might touch on it, but...
I don't want to step on that, but in opposition to that, which, the European doctrine that Columbus went with, which posits an empty land...
Yes.
The Deuteronomy story does not present it that way. Obviously, we both looked at, all these nations that God is going to clear out. But I also think of, we looked at Deuteronomy 7, but I also think of the next chapter, where it says, so, when you enter the land and you live in houses which you didn't build, etc., don't forget how you got here. So there's already structures there that somehow are going to become theirs. I mean, the image of when you live in houses that you didn't build... is really the occupation.
It is exactly
over other people's houses.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that ambiguity throughout.
Yeah, that's literally what happened in 1948.
Yeah.
If you've read the book, the Lemniture begins, Sandy Toland book, it's taught often. And there are many, many such stories. Yeah. So it's really striking. And I'm getting to Columbus. We're heading to Columbus. One of the stopping places, right? But of course, another place where this moment takes us is these lines. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over. The way he inhabits that story gives me chills. I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. I'm so happy tonight. Not worried about anything. My eyes are seeing the glory. And so for him, right, again, my people, we as a people, and we as a people, African Americans, but where King had arrived by this point in his life, we have to assume that this is much broader than that. Again, so there is, I keep wanting to come back to this vision, the positive side of this. Again, what that means. We will get there, that somehow living, able to just to live together, to appreciate living together, to appreciate otherness, difference, that's part of the territory for sure. voice calls out of a burning bush. A voice sends you across an ocean in 1492. A voice sells you to a white man who sends you across an ocean. Charleston, South Carolina, alone received some 187,000, just under half of all the slaves imported to the United States. By the close of Great Britain's official slave trade in 1807, about 3.2 million had been shipped just to the British Caribbean. Nearly all those stories had been lost. Now, there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to secure there. They resettled in pasture lands on the eastern border of the Delta, some four centuries, perhaps, after Abraham. It was long. One of the times that I was in Jerusalem, I had a month on my own, mostly in Jerusalem, and was staying in East Jerusalem, which is the Palestinian part, and would just wander through the old city. And one of my favorite churches is a church dedicated to St. Anne, mother of Mary. And one of those times I was there, the ruins, a lot of archaeological discoveries there. The ruins of medicinal baths were clients of the god Asclepius gathered in hopes of healing. It's here the Gospel of John tells us that John cured a man who was ill for 38 years. By the middle of the 5th century, a church had been built on the spot. So suggesting that just the idea that this was the place goes back a long time. Survived the edict of the Sultan Hakun in 1009. That all churches should be destroyed. This one survived that. Certainly existed at the beginning of the Crusader occupation, served by a group of Benedictine nuns. Saladin, great warrior, right, transformed the church into a Muslim theological school on the 25th of July, 1192. How do we know that? There's an inscription above the door. So 1192, exactly three centuries later, the king and queen of Spain expelled all Muslims and Jews from their country, ending what had been centuries of trade in music and poetry, philosophy and theology, a golden age in Andalusia, 1492, same year. So there's something to me very striking about this. There's this voyage of discovery that's going to lead to the discovery of a new land that's going to be thought of as a promised land. The same year, there is this expulsion of Muslims and Jews and the ending of this period of extraordinary harmony. According to Columbus, the theologian Catherine Keller writes, the Lord chosen as the divine instrument for the fulfillment of the ancient prophecy. He would be the one to rescue Christianity before the apocalypse, which Columbus believed was going to happen in 155 years after he sets out for what turned out to be, you know, the new land. By spreading Christianity to the unsaved pagan populations around the world, providing the gold for financing the crusade to recapture the Holy Sepulchre from the infidel. So it all ties in. You get the gold from a new land, you save the pagans, you use the gold to send warriors and to redeem Jerusalem. This is why God led Columbus to the other world, where so many heathens and so much gold were to be found. To this end, God bestowed upon this herald not only the requisite marine talents, but also special illumination, a light, this is quoting Columbus, a light which comforted me with its rays of marvelous clarity. He hears a voice that sends him forth. You may rejoice, Columbus writes to Ferdinand and Isabella, when I tell you, in the name of these same Hebrew prophets, that you are assured of certain victory in the enterprise of Jerusalem, if you have. With gold, Columbus wrote, likely thinking of papal indulgences, one can even get souls into paradise. And so I'm also struck by Columbus's association with gold. And then I go back to the Du Fu poem, where he goes up there and he says, the gold, I mean, it's like lying there. Gold and silver ore are there. And the hermit pays no attention to it. Yeah. All right. A brief detour. And this gets us close to the doctrine of discovery. But again, I'm thinking about this idea of civilization, the cradle of civilization. This is a book called Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror. What this writer has done is to take the idea of enclosure that goes back to Britain, right, 17th and 18th century Britain, and then applies it to what happened in the United States to the Native Americans and the loss of land, and then what happened to the Palestinians. Right. But he takes us back to England. The idea of owning land was also part of a newly ascendant Enlightenment thinking about the role of landed property as a foundation for the rational organization of society. The individual who best personified this trend was John Locke. Of course, hugely influential in terms of the American founding fathers. John Locke. Although Locke is rightly considered a seminal theorist of property rights, themes in his labor and improvement-driven theory of entitlement to land had circulated long before Locke. Locke himself, and this I didn't know, Locke himself was an administrator for the Carolina Territories. So he was well aware of what was going on in this country, right? Late 17th century. His approach to landed property derives at least in part from his involvement in the colonial affairs of British North America. Reflecting this influence, Locke builds his argument about rights to land from the juxtaposition of two metaphorical protagonists. One, quote, the wild Indian from America, quote, who knows no enclosure and thus has no property in land, and the English planter who cultivates land in enclosed fields. There we have it. At the dawn of humanity, Locke observes, land was common. And in an oft-quoted passage, he likens this condition of universal common land to American Indian society when, quote, all the world was America. That's a haunting quote. When all the world was America, nobody owned the land. Nevertheless, if, quote, God gave the world to man in common, it cannot be supposed he meant it should always remain common. And I love the syntax there. It should be supposed. Right? It's like passive construction. It should be supposed. By whom? Why? Following natural law, Locke insisted that God gave land to the industrious, and labor was to be his title to it. The industrious improved what God gave to humans by putting labor into the earth. By commanding humans to subdue and cultivate the earth, God was thus the authority for appropriation. In this way, subduing, cultivating, having dominion are joined together. Land improved through labor in two aspects. One, it's cultivated. Two, it's enclosed. As much land as a man tills, plants, improves, cultivates, so much is his property. He, by his labor, does, as it were, enclose it from the commons. For Locke, labor thus employed introduces private possessions. But this is the birth, this is the origin so much of what we have inherited. And this question of where have we come from and how did we get here? By enclosing land and cultivating the earth, the individual draws a boundary on an otherwise open landscape. With this boundary creates what lies at the core of property, the idea of exclusion expressed as mine and yours. Okay. All right. The follow-up of Sandy Toland's Lemon Tree book is a book called Children of Stone. The Power of Music in a Hard Land. It's a fascinating, wonderful book. I highly recommend it. He tells the story of a young man named Ramsey, who Tolan met very early on, and met in part because the boy himself, Ramsey, was famous, because there was a picture of him about to throw a stone during the Intifada, the first Intifada, I think it was, that went much. Ramsey, later on, became a highly accomplished musician, right? And became part of the symphony that the Jewish figure Daniel Barenboim and the Arab philosopher Alcyon Foster Edward Said created. One of the stories Sandy Tolan tells us this. Ramsey travels to France to study the viola, joins the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Then in July 2006, Hezbollah fighters, the Islamist militant group fighting to expel Israel from Lebanon, penetrated Israel's northern border, ambushed a pair of Israeli military Humvees, killed three soldiers, captured two others. Okay, so three soldiers dead, two captured. Israel's response? Massive air assault, roads, bridges, village infrastructure. 44 Lebanese in the first 24 hours were killed. Hundreds of thousands of civilians moved north to escape the bombing. Numbers would eventually exceed 1 million, leaving their homes. So this is going on in July 2006. Ramsey, Palestinian young man, who is very politically active, is following this on the news while the orchestra is traveling to Spain. So he's in his first rehearsals when this takes place, when the fighting breaks out. He's 26 years old, Palestinian refugee, walking into Seville's Plaza de Toros, the oldest bullfighting ring in the world. He's being rehearsals for Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Right? In the heart of Andalusia. A week later, okay, so Ramsey says, music can't be neutral. Right? And he's arguing with Barenboim and Said, right, about this. We have to make statements. We have to do something. Music can't be neutral. If music is neutral and art is neutral, why did Beethoven write the Ninth? About the time Ramsey arrived in Spain, Israel obliterated most of the tiny village of Cana in southern Lebanon, killing 28 people, all civilians. Many of the victims had been asleep, taking refuge in the basement of a three-story apartment building when Israeli bombs struck, the building collapsed. Some of the dead were children. I'm giving these details because these are the details Ramsey was trying to digest while he's figuring out, can I play Beethoven? 6 days later, Palace of Carlos V in Granada, within the medieval fortress known as the Alhambra, Ramsey joined the orchestra to play an evening concert. It was also in the Alhambra, Sandy Tolan reminds us, in 1492, that King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella issued their decree expelling Jews from Spain. As for the Muslims, the royal company forced them to choose between baptism. 500 years later, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, Israelis, Palestinians, Spaniards, Egyptians, one Lebanese violinist played music together in a palace named after the Holy Roman Emperor. Yeah. So there is the image, right? And the image of that orchestra is the image of Andalusia. And that's what that was the dream of Barenboim and Said, of crossing these lines, crossing, forming this bridge. The symbolic moment is astonishing. So 1492. So what in this country we have celebrated, and it's become more questionable, Columbus Day, no doubt about it. But as a nation, we have celebrated Columbus Day and the discovery of this country. The beginning of the great American experiment in some ways, right, happened simultaneously with the ending of this golden age in Andalusia. So I keep wondering, right, and it's the same in a way with the Abraham story, right, that we have these beginnings, we have these dreams, and almost at the there at the beginning, we can see something happening that's going to close those doors. Yeah. Yeah. So too, you know, I went here 2 days ago, 1948, from Israel, I mean, the founding of the state of Israel, 1967, you know, taking over Jerusalem, occupying Jerusalem. This was an apocalyptic moment. This was the Messiah. There was one rabbi who said very explicitly, there was, you know, somebody who was in charge at that moment of the occupation, decided and had the military, right, basically withdraw from the Temple Mount, because that person knew that if they really did, you know, take over the Temple Mount, you have war, you know, all over the Middle East. One rabbi said, if we'd been allowed, take the Temple Mount, the Messiah would have come that day. That was the feeling. That was the feeling. Yeah. The year after Columbus returned from his final voyage to the Americas in 1504, groups of Africans began arriving. So this is part of that narrative. By 1867, 12.5 million Africans had been sold into New World slavery. Of the 11 million or so who survived the Middle Passage, about 388,000 were shipped directly to what became the United States. John Cotton preached, John Cotton preached of the land of promise to John Winthrop's Puritan voyagers aboard the Arabella as they were about to set sail from Southampton in 1630, drawing his text from Samuel 7:10. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more, neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them anymore. We are entered into covenant with God for this work, John Winthrop said, but the covenant was distinctly conditional, for if we can learn to delight in each other, make others' condition our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission, Winthrop said. The Lord will be our God and delight to dwell among us as his own people and will command a blessing upon us. So just as the qualification with Abraham about righteousness and justice, Winthrop, at least in this moment, recognized this is conditional. If we deal falsely with our God in this work, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. We shall surely perish out of the good land. That's John Winthrop. Cotton Mather likened John Winthrop, who, quote, carried a colony of chosen people into an American wilderness to Moses. These are very explicit. We know these stories. This is so deeply embedded in our consciousness as Americans, that we are the Israelites. We are the ones who are inhabiting the Promised Land. On July 4, 1776, the Continental Congress instructed Franklin, Jefferson, and John Adams to design a seal for the United States. A few weeks later, Franklin proposed this image. I'm quoting Franklin. Moses standing on the shore and extending his hand over the sea, thereby causing the same to overwhelm Pharaoh, who was sitting in an open chariot, a crown on his head and a sword in his hand, raised from a pillar of fire in the clouds reaching to Moses. That was going to be the national seal. Jefferson's version, a representation of the children of Israel in the wilderness, led by a cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night. So both Jefferson and Franklin, good deists, this is the image, right, that they saw as central to, right, the founding of the states. jumping forward a few centuries. My son writes Ta-Nehisi Coates. Familiar with Ta-Nehisi Coates, great contemporary African American writer. He's writing a book, literally writing a book to his son about contemporary African American experience. He writes, "That Sunday, with that host on that news show, I tried to explain as best I could within the time allotted." Right? He's been describing sitting down for an interview about Ferguson and what's been going on. But at the end of the segment, the host flashed a widely shared picture of an 11-year-old black boy tearfully hugging a white police officer. And we can easily picture this, right? This is, you know, national news. They've got 3 minutes with Ta-Nehisi Coates, and they want to end with something uplifting. So they flash this picture, white police officer, 11-year-old black kid, hugging, tearfully hugging the white police officer. Then she asked me about hope. And I knew then that I had failed, he writes. I remembered that I had expected to fail. I wondered again at the indistinct sadness welling up in me. Why was I sad? I came out of the studio and walked for a while. It was a calm December day. Families believing themselves white were out in the streets. Infants raised to be white were bundled in strollers. I was sad for these people, much as I was sad for the host and sad for all the people out there watching and reveling in the specious hope. I realized then why I was sad. When the journalist asked me about my body, what it was like she was asking me to awaken her from the most gorgeous dream. I've seen that dream all my life. It is perfect houses with nice lawns. It is Memorial Day cookout. Block associations, driveways. The dream's tree houses, Cub Scouts. The dream smells like peppermint, tastes like strawberry shortcake. And for so long, I've wanted to escape from this dream, to fold my country over my head like a blanket. But this has never been an option because the dream rests on our backs. The bedding made from our bodies. And knowing this, knowing that the dream persists by warring with the known world, the real world we live in, I was sad for the host, right, who's clinging to this dream. I was sad for all those families. I was sad for my country. But above all, in that moment, I was sad for you, my son. It's going to hurt now, said Amy. Anything dead coming back to life hurts. This passage from Toni Morrison's Blood. It's going to hurt now. Amy is this white girl, right, that Setha, the African American slave who's trying to escape with her kids, right, finds and heals. And she's talking literally. The children of Israel received the Torah in the desert. Exodus 32, verses 15, 16, also the Quran, Surah 7. The word Torah, writes the scholar Anton Wessels, was translated into Greek by nomos, law. The Arabic word Sharia has suffered a similar fate, usually translated as Islamic law. We know about Sharia law. Its primary meaning is path to the source. Namely of water that is so necessary for survival on one's way through the desert. But Torah also means signpost. It is the way pointed out to humankind. The children of Israel are granted this bread from heaven on their journey through the desert. The Torah, briefly put, is about doing justice and loving one's neighbor. To do justice and to show love is their daily bread. It is important to realize, Dr. Wessels writes, that the memory of the exodus of the children of Israel from Egypt was, as the prophet Amos emphasizes, not purely and simply for the people of Israel. Amos was called to preach against the violation of justice rampant in Israel, the extravagant city life in this goes back to what you've been talking about. Amos denies that the liberation movement of the Exodus is something that applies exclusively to Israel. The prophet expresses a castigating approach when Israel misuses this election for particularist propaganda. Are not you Israelites the same to me as the Cushites, declares the Lord? Did I not bring Israel up from Egypt, the Philistines from Kaphtor, the Arameans from Peor, and so on? How are we doing here? A dream of a new world, like Dorothy on that road to Kansas. She starts to sing before the tornado hits, someplace far away, someplace with color. And I'm old enough to remember, you know, that experience of, like, when people first got color TV sets. You could watch, you know, once a year, The Wizard of Oz was on TV. That moment when you reach all us, the doors open, and you're not in Kansas anymore. To go inside this place, an idea, a thought, a dream, could be Wounded Knee, Charleston or Chicago, Ferguson or Bethlehem, New Orleans or Gaza City, to cross over. But your flesh is not your own. Your name is not your own. Your child is not your own. This is a dream from which you cannot awaken. Other than in a few instances, Dr. Wesley writes, it goes very wrong with most of the kings in the Promised Land, and we may be going there with the Solomon story. Slavery arose already during the reigns of the first kings in Israel. The lines between forced labor and slavery are fluid. In the memory of the children of Israel, the forced labor they had to perform in building cities in Egypt was a true period of slavery. After the conquest of the land, however, they themselves compelled the Canaanites to do forced labor, which also could often have been equated with complete slavery. Summon people to servitude, to slavery, was a special right of the king. Solomon especially is known for developing a harsh forced labor policy. The conclusion should be clear. Solomon's politics introduced a fundamental social change into the Promised Land. The rural population bled dry to finance a military budget. This should sound pretty familiar. Solomon's choice for the most modern military equipment of his time turned him into a despot. The great prince of peace, Solomon, had in turn become Pharaoh. In July 1846, the United States flag replaced the Mexican flag when four U.S. warships anchored in Monterey Bay. Captain William Mervin went ashore to demand surrender. During the almost 80-year period of Spanish, Russian, and Mexican rule, the coastal region between San Diego and Fort Ross, California Indian population dropped to 150,000 from something like 310,000. Under U.S. rule, within 25 years, the number 30,000. By 1880, a census recorded roughly 16,000 California Indians. Quote, the savages were in the way, a historian wrote in 1890. The word's annals contained few comparable instances of swift depopulation. Practically a racial massacre, wrote the U.S. Indian Affairs Commissioner in 1935. A caravan travels from the east, bearing food, wine, olive oil, fruits from far fields, pomegranates and apricots, cherries, ripe melons, bearing stories of a land without borders, where music flows as freely as the wine. Songs are shared and compared. They grow and change like the fruit in the fields. So too the people. We know this about art. Just that breathing and moving back and forth between cultures. The caravan crosses the Tigris and the Euphrates, crosses Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Jordan until it reaches the river. It is not wide, but it is deep with possibilities. So the camels, their riders stop and pause at the east bank of the river. While the animals drink, the riders wait in silence, watching the river flow south into the Sea of Galilee, south to Aqaba and into another dream. Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rachel, Moses and Miriam, David, Solomon, the Persians, Macedonians, Maccabees, Romans, Jesus and Mary, Paul, John, and Muhammad in his midnight flight to Jerusalem. The Umayyads, the Abbasids, the Fatimids, Saladin, King Richard, the Turks, Mamluks, Napoleon, T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. The River Jordan is not deep, except in stories. They drink from words that will never run dry. They cross into the Canaan of the imagination. And that's true if you've been to the River Jordan. I mean, it's not, and it is terribly political. Terribly political. Right? You see, you know, people getting baptized. It's questionable. All right. Okay, we need to finish up here. Okay. A couple more here. There's a wonderful book called Lawrence in Arabia that's about the story of T.E. Lawrence. It describes his character William Yale, who was sent by Standard Oil to Israel and to the Middle East to do explorations of oil. This is 1917-1918. 1917 is the Balfour Declaration, when England makes a promise to the Jews that there will be a state. Right? So a huge period of time, right at the end of World War. And then, you know, the ending of the Ottoman Empire, Britain takes over. William Yale is Standard Oil's man. He reads this essay. He finds this essay that had been written back in March 1917, right, that had methodically delineated the fissures that divided and subdivided the country. Right. The writer described in a few words, he suggests the bitterness which exists in southern Palestine against the Zionists, the bitterness of feeling shared alike by Muslims and Christians. Recent developments tend only to aggravate the natural hatred of the Palestinian for those Jews who come to Palestine declaring their country to be theirs. This was published in March 1917. It had been written 2 years before that, in 1915. Yale realized that he already met the author once. It was T.E. Lawrence. As he probed further, William Yale ascertained that already in early 1918, the plans for the Jewish nation were in fact quite well advanced. Indeed, within the Zionist Commission was an ongoing debate over what should become of Palestine's Arab population once nationhood had been achieved. With those arguing that cheap Arab labor was essential to the growth and success of Zionism, pitted against those who foresaw the day when non-Jews would have to be expelled. In the end, it came down to numbers that, quote, as in the American South, the white population would never submit to a domination by the Negroes, so a Jewish minority in Palestine would never submit to a domination by an Arab majority. That was already apparent in 1918. So this is a long, long story that is now literally 100 years old. 100 years old. I need to stop. I'll finish with this. Just briefly. The main transportation routes out of the Delta, Mississippi Delta, led straight north to Chicago, the home of the Chicago Defender, national black newspaper. The publisher launched what he called the Great Northern Drive on May 15, 1917, so exactly contemporary. He invented slogans, the flight out of Egypt, promoted songs, bound for the promised land, going into Canaan. This, of course, is the great black migration from the south to the industrial north. Right? I'm from Chicago. So, yeah. Bound for the promised land, going into Canaan. In some cases, after the train crossed the Ohio River, the migrants signaled the event by kissing the ground and holding prayer services. I was born a black woman, and now I have become a Palestinian, writes the American poet, June Jordan. It is time to. I'll finish there. Thanks a lot. we'll continue tomorrow and talk a little bit about Jesus in Jerusalem and again this question of how did we get here?